If I were going to choose a time to live, of all the times that I can think of, it would be right now in the last part of this 20th century, because I honestly believe that we're not going to have too many other centuries to choose from. I think that, I don't know what you feel about the speed of things in the world, or how fast things are happening toward what Christ said was going to be the last few events. We got three choice seats right here. But it really seems to me that the momentum is picking up, and things are really happening toward Christ coming again. And I think that this is what makes it the most exciting time to live. I don't know. You may have rather have lived in a more peaceful time, or a more complacent time, we say, but because there is quite a bit of action going on. But it makes me think that it's time for all of us to get a piece of the action. Whatever it is, we ought to be right in it and not standing on the sidelines, because there's too much of interest and excitement going on. Well, that may make you wonder what my topic was assigned this morning. And it made me sort of wonder, too. Here was the topic that they gave me. So if you don't really enjoy what we have to say this morning, you can talk to the conference office. How to keep up with current events, how to know what's going on in the world, and how to take advantage of opportunities to serve. And it seems kind of like three topics, but I think it all sort of comes down to this thing of being a part of the action in this last third of the 20th century that we are living in. And I'm happy with that. Well, we'll take it up first, sort of in two parts. First, the current events and the world. And before we say how to keep up with current events, maybe you all know that. But I thought we ought to maybe mention why. Why should you keep up with what's going on in the world? Is there any good reason, or why a Christian should care or take part in or know what's going on in the world? I have down four what I think are good reasons, but we'll quickly go through them because we have a lot to discuss. First, though, we're not of this world as believers in Christ. The Word says we're not of the world, but we are in it. And of all the places to be, there is a lot to be interested in. When those fellows go to the moon, they're really not going to see a whole lot. As exciting as that is, they're not going to see as much as there is to see and do here in the world, on Earth. It's a good trip, but I think they'll want to come back. And, pardon me, we can know what's going on in the world, and we can interpret it from God's point of view. We can see the events taking place in the Middle East and interpret it from what the Scripture says is scheduled to take place over there, or what the Scripture says about the various peoples over there. And the very places you're reading in the news today are the places that are mentioned in the Old Testament prophets and in the New Testament. We can interpret what happens in Europe. This week's Time magazine says that it looks like sooner or later the common market will include 10 member nations. Well, it just happens that prophecy says that 10 member nations of the revived Roman Empire, whatever that concludes, will figure in the last days. Well, that's interesting. It may not be the same 10 nations, but it's interesting that it comes that close to stating what the prophets have said. And so many things you've seen happen in the news and the current events that were in the prophets. I think of the airplane being prophesied, and television, I believe, is implied in Scripture, where In one place it speaks of all the world seeing the two dead bodies lying in the streets of Jerusalem. How would they do that? For 3 days, the two dead bodies of the prophets or the witnesses lay in the streets of Jerusalem, and all the world looked at them and rejoiced and sent presents to each other. How could they do that in 3 days' time if they weren't seeing it by satellite? Who knew about satellites when that was written? And that's just one example. We can interpret what's going on from God's point of view. It's like wearing a watch. You can know what time it is, almost. But secondly, I think a point of contact in conversation with Christians and non-Christians is a good reason for us to keep up with what's going on in the world. You meet someone and they say, I played golf with Arnold Palmer. And you said, oh yes, do you work with him? Mm-hmm. Or or I, something else, I was speaking with Robert Finch this morning. Oh, friend of yours? No, we need to know in order to not be completely ignorant when we have some kind of contact with non-Christians and other Christians. One of the people last year who was going overseas with a Christian organization, I said something to him. It was right around the political convention time. I said, well, it looks like we're going to nominate a president or something like that. He says, oh, who are we nominating? I thought, oh, you really are out of it. But I don't mean that we need to necessarily know every accident on every corner of every street because there are too many of them to keep up with. But I think you know that what I mean. The things of importance and significance. It helps you in identifying with their field of interest. The person you're trying to win the friendship of a non-Christian girl who's interested in art or music or some other field, social work. Something ought to be able, some point of contact would be made in your conversation if you knew a little bit about what's going on in that field that you can discuss with her. Maybe not everything, but at least something that lets her know that you are with it and part of this generation, which would then give you maybe an opening to speak with her about spiritual things. But they're really turned off if we don't recognize a big name or a famous event or something like that that they think that everybody ought to know. And thirdly, as participation, as a citizen, as an influence for good, we need to take part. We have a country that God gave us, a very specially privileged nation that God gave us right out of His own hand and 200 years ago, and we ought to be proud of it. We ought to be able to take our part in events and in helping as a citizen to be an influence, a Christian influence, for good in that country. Many times back in Washington, people, they don't know what the people are thinking in the, what they call the grassroots, which is us, unless they hear from us. Unless George Gallup goes out and asks people what they think. And sometimes those polls are really surprising. They're pretty far off from what they're thinking back in Washington or in the other power centers of the country. So to keep our eyes open, to be ready to do anything that will be helpful or constructive in taking our part as a citizen in this country. And the fourth reason I think is the most important for keeping up with what's going on is for prayer. To pray specifically for world affairs, for the president, for the Congress, for the Vietnam War, for crucial things everywhere. Just for example, one thing I pray for for Vietnam, we want our men to come home. We want, first of all, we want many of them to find Christ while they're out there in the battlefield situations, and we want them to be toughened into men whom God can use as His soldiers on the battlefront. We want the influence of the gospel to be spread through even the adverse circumstances of the war. But One thing I pray for is this land reform program President Tu has initiated very quickly now that he realizes the Americans are really going to leave. He's initiated a land reform program which should have been done a long time ago, where they divide up the land and give every peasant a few acres of land. Well, I pray because of the corruption and the bribery and the dishonesty in official and military life over there, which is taken as a fact of life, I pray against that. I pray for honest people to administer this land reform program and that the peasants will have their confidence won. And because this would be the way to strengthen the South Vietnamese people into a unit politically so that they would be able to stand and not go all to pieces when the Americans pull out. Well, this kind of praying I would maybe think is strategic. It's important that land reform work. Much more important than that a battle on any given front be won, because that will contribute to their permanent well-being. In my opinion, I may be wrong. Or pray for especially for one of these battles that gets a lot of propaganda and publicity, where they're trying to find out whether the South Vietnamese soldiers can take it on their own. And there's nothing that would be more damaging than for them to have a humiliating defeat when they try to do something on their own. So that battle is one to pray for. And as we see these things happening, and then specific issues in Congress, and not that you can keep your nose in their business all the time, but to have to pray in towards specific things that we feel would be right or beneficial. We've heard a lot of criticism of Supreme Court decisions on many things, prayer in the schools and so on. Well, our specific prayers sometimes can change a vote. Do you believe that? And I think that zeroing in on certain persons or certain leaders at specific times. I pray for the president that he will, that his decisions will be made with conscious confidence in the Lord, and that the Lord will get glory from him through any success. It's too easy for any person to say, well, I won that battle, or I won my point on this treaty or that committee or something. But that the Lord will afterwards be glorified in these public decisions or in these battles that are fought. Because God makes it very plain through all of the Old Testament that any nation that honors him will prosper. And the nations that do not will not, regardless of their resources or anything of the kind, or their smart generals. Well, I think we agree on the idea of prayer for specific things, but sometimes it's just easy to drop out, drop out and pull my little world around me and not say, well, the news is too bad. I won't watch it. I won't listen to it. I won't read it. May as well drop out and wait for the Lord to come. Go up on the top of the hill, But he wants us to be in it. Whatever battle there is spiritual, and he wants us to be in it, because there's too few of us to anybody to be a dropout. I think that well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But as to how, a few ideas on how. How do you have any trouble keeping up with what's going on in the world? I have to work at it. I find it's just a continual matter of working at it, like anything else that you want to accomplish. But there are some quicker ways and some slower, less efficient ways. One, I think, is to read one news magazine a week. Fairly thoroughly. I skip the, Time is one. The first half of it includes national world affairs. The last half is features like art, television, advertising, business, and so on. And you may have a field of interest back here, Mike. You may be in a interest in the business section and all the international affairs, and it really is interesting if you are. Or The cinema is not worth reading. A very occasional book review is worth reading in the back here. Generally speaking, the front section is pretty vital, although it is biased. They have most of the magazines and the press and the TV are liberal-oriented, if you have noticed. And the thing to do is not swallow everything they say, but argue with it. You know, have your own opinion and decide spot where their prejudices come in and substitute your own. U.S. News is another, it's a very good one. Newsweek I don't have a copy of here, but U.S. News spells things out in pretty much topical fashion. The ABM debate, the taxes, Russia and the moon, medical fees, which are under consideration now, and the Congress. And then they have little short squibs, which are more factual than Time. Time is more opinionated. And this, the U.S. News, I think, seems to be more just facts, and you can make your own opinions, which is probably preferable.
You would recommend that then?
U.S. News? Well, I'm not as familiar with U.S. News, but a lot of people do prefer it. And I think it perhaps is much more fair and unbiased. Now, what is your opinion?
Hearing last night Mr. Sanchez saying how Time and Life have both downgraded Billy Graham, for one thing. That's just one example of how leftist, you know, they're getting, and we're seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know business people are switching from Time to U.S. News just for what you say, that U.S. News presents the facts and you can make up your own mind.
Right, and Time definitely does have its biases. It has, I'd hesitate to name them in the open group, but I know what I think they are. But Newsweek, I'm not familiar with that at all. I read Time, but I try not to let it bother me. But U.S. News is very clear. They give you both sides of a given thing without trying to pull you into a tie you in a knot over their opinion of it. But anyway, the daily paper is probably not the best way, because it takes you a long time to wade through and sift out the really vital things. So I think a weekly news magazine is probably my favorite of the ways to keep up. Maybe one TV newscast a day, if you like CBS or NBC's newscast or ABC, you might get used to watching one of those. They're pretty comprehensive. Only redeeming the Time is always in the back of my mind. I mean, during the commercials, review two or three verses. Don't sit there and gaze out the window. You know, that's 2 good minutes lost unless you really want to buy soap. So the time element in all of this is uppermost, because our time belongs to the Lord, and if what we can accomplish in the least possible time with the least waste of time is the best, I think. And as you keep up, I find as you keep up, it's easier to do than to do it from scratch. If you just pick up a magazine after dropping out for 6 months, you say, let me see now, who is Melvin Laird? I haven't heard of him before. Or, now this fellow named Agnew, what does he do? But if you keep up from day to day, all you have to do is glance and say, Fulbright fulminates again, and you know what it's all about. You may start thinking I'm a conservative. Well, avoid the time wasters, like in the, it's easy, don't get strung off with the crossword puzzles and Ann Landers when you're keeping up with the news, unless you chalk that off of your budget of entertainment or relaxation for the week. But the same way with the TV, I like to look at the TV schedule and decide what I'm going to watch. Watch it and turn it off. That way you don't get hooked into a two-hour movie. Waste that 2 hours. Did you ever do that? If you want to watch a movie, chalk it off your entertainment budget, but be sure you say, well, I've had it for this week, you know. I don't know, that may be a little severe. But the point is, like I tried maybe 1 hour, one program a week of just relaxation. I like to watch Glenn Campbell when he's on, just for entertainment. But it's easy to slip into watching something every night for entertainment, and that's wasted time because you don't get your Bible study done. Well, I think that's the general idea on time spent and how to do it in what I think is a hurry. Now, what to do about it? What to do about it once we have kept up with the news and what's going on in the world? Well, we've already talked about praying specifically. Enter into the battle wherever you feel that the Lord would have you pray and intercede for things. I don't know what. He might burden one person for one thing and one for another, but if Christians are praying, it can change events. Just remember that, whether they're small, whether they're in Biafra or where they are, Christians can change by moving the hand of God, because this is what He has told us. He's promised us this. And secondly, write a thoughtful letter sometime to your congressman or to the newspaper in your town, or to someone else. This is a silly example maybe, but the essay on Marxism was written by a man in Time magazine, and he wrote an essay on Marxism, Marxist thought, which I thought was very good. And I wrote him a letter, decided to write him a letter. Enclosed this bridge tract, which the navigators have out. Have you seen the new bridge tract?
No.
I thought, being a PhD, he might be able to understand those pictures. Excuse me, any PhDs are here, I'm sure. But I wrote him and I complimented him on his fine presentation of the Marxism thought. And I said it seemed very strange to me that these philosophies all came right up to the edge of the real answer and never got there, which is Jesus Christ, and gave a little personal word of testimony. And I asked if by any possibility he had ever made this consideration himself, and enclosed this tract and offered something else if he wanted to. Now, he may never read it, but I prayed that it would get to his desk somehow and would influence little drops of water and little grains of sand, you know. And somehow I believe that God may use it. But these things, and writing to your congressmen and senators and so on, keeping a Christian voice in things, because you are part of the country, just like the non-Christians, just like Madeline Murray. Mm-hmm. And she's made enough noise for one person in the prayer and the taking prayer out of the schools and so on. I don't mean we have to be a crank. And I think that all our communications of this sort should be courteous and humble, but nevertheless vocal. Because these can make a difference. Billy Graham met a senator's wife in Washington back during this crusade, and she was what I'd call a fanatic Christian. Her fanaticism went a little too far because she hurt people. But nevertheless, Billy Graham shook this woman's hand. He says, "Your letter was one of the things which helped us decide to come to Washington," and she was amazed, you know, she was dumbfounded. But this was going the other direction, letters from a senator's wife to Billy Graham. But he told her that your letter was what helped us decide to come to Washington. So you never know what to do about it. Pray, write to your congressman, and make contacts in your field of interest and share the gospel. If we know what's going on, well, say you're interested in architecture or art or something. I drop in at the Fine Arts Center once in a while and look over the exhibits, and I got acquainted with the secretary there at the Fine Arts Center. And when General Wilson Hafner was in town, I took her as my guest to the luncheon where he gave his testimony. Well, this is in a field of given interest, why you can make a contact through some of this that you wouldn't have maybe just in your ordinary Christian round of things in church and so on. And then get involved in civic and social efforts. Volunteer. It doesn't mean you have to. We have to all be club women or spend 48 hours every day in some kind of public service. But there are ways to make contacts. Maybe that's not our problem. Maybe we have more contacts now than we know what to do with. But usually, there may be a problem. Other than, you know, the milkman, the postman, and the girl that works next to us at the next desk, or the neighbor. Our imagination sometimes doesn't go too far beyond in how to contact people for the Lord. And I noticed this, okay, I clipped this out of a local paper. It says, Help Wanted. Girls Club of Colorado Springs, volunteers to help girls learn sewing and cooking and things. American Cancer Society, so some of it's just listing money. But you can answer the phone for people that are thinking about suicide if you have the stamina to do that. You can volunteer to take a six-hour watch answering the phone on suicide referral. And I don't know what that involves, what qualifications they require, but I imagine they're always looking for people. They're always looking for people to do things of civic and social nature, which maybe 2 hours a week could bring us in contact with people who would be receptive to the gospel. And I'm not saying that always it has to be a pure opportunity for the gospel in order for us to serve. I think civic service is appropriate for anybody, Christian or non-Christian. But it's just the idea that there are many things, many ways in which we can be involved in civic and social efforts. And I am just saying it because I'm saying it to myself too, and I'm very much a failure at it. But this gets us involved with people. I noticed in the paper that Tricia Nixon tutors two little slum kids that in their schoolwork, and those are two little kids they'll never forget through all their lives that they got to go to the White House and get help with their arithmetic. And it may make a difference. It will make a difference in their lives. But somebody said, they objected. They said, well, if the president wants to help education in our town, he should appropriate more money and not do it this way. And somebody said, well, it's just a political move. But she probably wanted to help. She probably wanted to do something worthwhile, and so she's tutoring these two children. Do you have any comments on or opportunities that you know about, or whether this is worthwhile or not? We, I'm sure each in our own towns we have these things, and probably a lot of you are doing things that are of that nature. But so much for keeping on with what's going on in the world and being involved in it. I believe in it, and I hope sooner or later to practice it. Regarding opportunities to serve, now I think the things that they had in mind were not only opportunities to serve in these miscellaneous ways we've talked about, but opportunities to serve as a career. Now a lot of us are doing different things. We're in offices and hospitals and schools and homes. And so our career so far is different. I think if there's one thing we all have in common, it's the desire to be productive and significant. You don't just want to be a ward on society until the Lord comes, as we were. But you want to do something that's significant. Or you want to, well, they say that a basic need is to be someone. Well, I think maybe it's better expressed by doing something. Maybe you were disgusted, as I was, to hear about these hippies that moved down to Taos, and they were so wealthy that they fished out cash to pay for land. They bought land and promptly settled down and went on welfare. Well, this makes me angry. For people to be, not that the fact that if they want to sit back and smoke marijuana and loaf all day, but the fact that they're not producing anything, they're not productive, they're just a parasite on society. And your taxes are supporting those people, probably. It won't work. We've been brought up, all of us, in a culture, in a country where people are taught to work hard, and hard work is a virtue, and everybody carries his own weight. Isn't that right? Because there's a feeling of worthwhileness when we put out a little bit. But in our time and our strength and our education and our resources, we think of as something to invest in one thing or another. Now, a lot of people think of the whole thing of investing all they have and are in enjoying themselves, in happiness, of being happy. And other people invest in other things. But we think of it as something to invest. We want to be productive. We want to be significant in some way. And believe it or not, being single has its advantages. Might want to argue with that a while. That's all right. We can. There's disadvantages too, I'm sure. But I hope that all of us realize that if we are single, it's by God's choice, and not just a slip up somewhere. We shouldn't feel like second-class citizens. And I know this is a real possibility, isn't it? You kind of feel like, well, you know, not quite. Didn't quite make it. I know that some of you, when you do make it, won't feel that way, but the single girl feels there's a little something way down inside that sort of says, well, just a little bit second class here. So it's by choice. We have to tell and we have to know that if we are single, and as long as we are single, it's by choice and hopefully by God's choice, because otherwise somebody made a mistake. And what are these advantages? One is mobility. You can, you're free, if you're single, you're free to go and without probably too many strings tied. You may, of course, have family responsibilities at home, but generally, mobility is something that a single person enjoys that someone with a household or family couldn't even think of. We have freedom of choice as to where we'll go, what we'll do, and when we'll do it. And that choice can be daily, and it can be a lifetime. It can be that freedom of choice applies, I mean, daily, and it applies most any time. There's more freedom of choice. And we have more time. Did you ever spend the afternoon with a girlfriend who has 3 children under 5? Did you ever try to get a coherent conversation in with her while she's, you have more time as a single girl. Somehow it just works out that way. And we should value this. 1 Corinthians 7, I'm sure you know it, 34. Let's see, I have a Williams New Testament here, which I like very much. And tells us that we have all this time that we should devote properly. An unmarried woman or a girl is concerned about the affairs of the Lord so as to be consecrated in body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of the world and how she can please her husband. And picking up 6 kids with a station wagon twice a day, taking them swimming lessons and so on. And time is so vital. And we have it all to spend for the Lord. All right, back to the idea of investment. We want to invest. And knowing Christ and loving Him, it's the whole focus of our being is, or should be, if our hearts are right with Him, to invest this time for Him. It isn't automatic, because you know what human nature does, left to itself? Builds a little shell old cage and lives for self, me, my stuff, my entertainment. It's not automatic. We could drift in entirely into a pattern of living for self. And a good thing sometimes is just to question ourselves occasionally. Am I doing this for myself, or is this really for the Lord, whatever I'm doing at the moment? Is He being glorified some way through what I am or I'm being or doing right now? Or is it just for me? One of my verses for this year is John 8:29, for I do always those things which please Him. I claim this, I pray this, that I will be doing always, that means daily, that means hourly, at any given moment, that I will be doing always those things which please Him. And if He keeps us on that track, then we won't be living for self. But our tendency, our natural tendency, the tendency of the flesh is just to pull us into a self orbit, which is not very pleasant, really. This requires being in His Word. Of course, you've had this, and if you've been around the Navigators very long, you've heard this. Being in the Word, a strong prayer life, living in close touch with the Lord. And the reason for this is to pull us away from this human tendency to live for self and to be non-productive. But to keep His interests at heart, we must constantly be in His Word and in prayer and maintain a close devotional life with Him. It's gravity. It's the force of gravity that pulls us down. So it comes down to the Great Commission. The challenge to me is to be productive, to be useful to God in some way, the way He chooses, the place He chooses for fulfillment of His one great last order, the Great Commission. Now, what is the Great Commission? Does anybody know? Go ye into all the world and make disciples. Teach all nations, it says one place. Make disciples, baptizing them, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. The Great Commission is stated many different places, and it boils down to going into all the world, making disciples for Him. And I'm sure that we're aware of this and zeroed in on it. But there are some things about this that we want to discuss just in these last few minutes. And that is, I have been reading in John in Williams here. And John 21 had some pertinent thoughts for those who are followers of Christ. John 21, after Jesus had risen and gone, wasn't with them daily and constantly, Peter may have gotten just a little bit discouraged with the whole business. He says, I'm going fishing. And the other fellow says, okay, we'll go with you. And there may have been just a note of throwing the whole thing over. There may not. But it sounded like he just decided on a sudden impulse, I'm going back to fishing. Now, I'm going fishing doesn't mean like you or me going fishing, but he said, I'm going back to what I was doing before this ever happened. And so they all piled in the boat, fished all night. And how much did they get? Nothing. Jesus stood on the shore the next day, and disciples did not know it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, lads, you have no fish, have you? I like to read it that way, instead of, you have no fish, have you? You have no fish, have you? Like, did you really expect this thing to work? And they answered, no. Then he said to them, set your net on the right side of the boat and you'll catch them. They did so, and they could not drag it in for the big catch. Immediately, what did they know? They knew that was Jesus. So that disciple whom Jesus loved tenderly said, to Peter, it is the Lord. It's the Lord. The Lord's come. He's pulled us out of this mess that we drifted back into. And then Peter jumped out and ran ashore, and they found he had a charcoal fire all made and fish on it and bread. And graciously, he said, bring some of the fish that you've caught. We'll have breakfast. And so they brought some of the fish, and he let them bring in what they'd gotten after they obeyed him. In disobedience, they hadn't gotten anything, but after they obeyed what Christ said, they got a lot of fish. Now, this fish represented their security, didn't it? The security of knowing how to make a living. Here they'd been traveling around in evangelism and healing and all this business, odd hours, having to scrape food out of nowhere to feed 5,000 people, and it had been a pretty hectic life. And all of a sudden they thought, boy, security is in fishing. That's it. Now, I may be reading that into it, but they were going back to the thing in which they felt secure and a source of support. That was the way they made their living. So Jesus said, Peter, you think, he may have said something like this, you looking for security in those fish? Well, obey me and you'll have it. But you notice, don't you, Peter, that security is only by obeying me. It isn't going back to your fishing, because you noticed that you didn't catch anything all night. And then, secondly, first as a means of security, Jesus had to pry Peter loose from those fish. He had to get him loose from those fish. And as a means of security and a source of support. And secondly, as an emotional attachment. There was something that was familiar about it, like going back to a place where you used to live and thinking, well, here's where I really live, here's where my attachment is, or what place where you live now. The emotional attachment to those fish. So Jesus said, regarding this emotional attachment, after they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Peter, Simon, son of John, are you more devoted to me than you are to these things? Peter answered him, yes, Lord, you know that I tenderly love you. And Jesus said to him, then feed my lambs. Then he asked him another time, are you really devoted to me? Yes, Lord, you know that I tenderly love you. Then be a shepherd to my sheep. For the third time he asked him, do you really tenderly love me? And Peter was hurt because he asked him a third time. So he said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I do tenderly love you. Now, Jesus said to him, then feed my sheep. Jesus had to pry Peter loose from the fish as his source of security and his source of support, financial support. And he had to pry him loose from the fish as an emotional attachment. Does that say anything to us? Does he have you and does he have me on both of these counts? Does he have our hearts? He had asked Peter three times whether he really had his heart. Does the Lord Jesus have our hearts to such an extent that we're not tied to those fish for our security? One of a woman's greatest needs is security. And that includes financial support and so on. Financial security and security of all kinds. To the extent that we know that only in obedience to him, as Peter obeyed him when he put the net on the other side of the boat, does he know that he has our hearts to the extent that our security is only in obeying him? Now that's something to think about and to pray about. Does he have our hearts to the extent that there isn't an emotional attachment to the things that would take precedence over him in our hearts? Are we attached to anything emotionally, or are we attached to anything in a form of security that takes first place? Can he pry us loose from the fish if he wants to? All right, the second thing I noticed in this, or the next thing I noticed in this same sequence, right away, Jesus said to Peter, when you're young, you went where you wanted, when you're old, somebody's going to tie you up and stretch you out, and it's not going to be pleasant. He was telling them that he would be crucified or be martyred for the cause of Christ. Pretty tough assignment, wasn't it? But Peter's assignment was to go out and spread the gospel and be martyred for it. Now that's the way he was going to have to prove his love. And immediately, in his own human reaction, he said, Peter, Lord, what about this guy? He looked around, he saw John. What about John? What are you going to have John do? And Jesus said, never mind John. Never mind at all about John. I have plans for him too. But you are to keep on following me. So it turned out that he gave Peter and John quite different jobs. John got to go off and live on a resort island and write history. Pretty smooth, huh? Greek island, I understand millionaires fight over having their own island over there. But John had his own little Greek island, and he got to sit down and write. I enjoy writing, and I know that he probably enjoyed it too. Another job that John got was to take care of Jesus' mother. Well, now, wasn't that a funny job for the Great Commission? For one of the 12 or one of the 11 disciples to have you think that the least they could do is make him the bishop of something or other and send him off in a huge supervisory administrative position. Oh, taking care of Jesus' mother was one of his first jobs. In fact, it was the first job he was given. He says, mother, behold your son, and so on. Then, so a lot of us are called on by the Lord to take care of a relative or some family situation. And that can be just as much an assignment in the Great Commission as anything that looks much more glamorous. But it must be Jesus' assignment. Now, this is what I get out of this. He is the one who makes the assignments. Our jobs are different. I can't be jealous of what Jody does and all that she produces, because I know that God didn't give me Jody's job. He gave me my job, which, frankly, from day to day can look awfully, awfully insignificant, awfully unproductive. But I have to know that God gave me this job, and I have to stick to it, or else I'll be out of his will. Now, he wants to do the choosing. If he can completely get us loose from the fish, and I think the fish in each of our lives is different, he has various jobs for us to do, and he has the right job for each one of us. If we're going to get a piece of the action, we want to be sure it's the best piece. We want to be sure that we're getting the piece that he wants us to have of the action in the last part of this century, because there are many exciting pieces. Maybe in Williams, Arizona, maybe in Quito, Ecuador, maybe in Stockholm. So you see, it's how important it is to know what's going on in those places. But he needs to be the one to tell us where that job is to be, where that assignment, whether it's the Isle of Patmos or taking care of Jesus' mother or going out and giving our lives and dying for the gospel, like Peter did. Now, of course, the women were involved in this too. There were women who served and traveled with the disciples. They probably did their wash, cooked for them, and did other things. It said they ministered to them of their substance. In Luke 8:2 says this. Number of women who were serving in the things that women know how to do. Some of the things that have been, I think of different girls just offhand. And by the way, does this have to be with the navigators? Heresy. If you're going to serve the Lord, does it have to be inside the navigator framework? Does it have to be in the church, or it doesn't count? Doesn't have to be in the navigators, or it doesn't count? No, it doesn't. It has to be in service of the Great Commission. And anybody who's seeking to fulfill the Great Commission and following God's direction as to what part of the Great Commission that is front line service, no matter where it is. Mary Lou Schoonmaker is a nurse who has been around the Navigators a long time. She's nursing in the hospital, in the Latin American Mission Hospital in Costa Rica. And I think of Anita Marsman, who grew up in the Navigators, and by grew up, I mean grew up spiritually in the Navigator work. She had it on her heart to go and minister to in the Arab world, and the Navigators at that time wasn't sending any girl to the Arab world. And so she applied for several missions and was tentatively accepted by several. And they said, study French. She went and studied French. She got another degree. She got a master's so that her whole time wouldn't be taken up staff nursing, and she could have time for young student nurses to spend time with girls. Took several years to get her education and go over there, and she just went over as an employee of the hospital. Well, by the time she got there, well, the Navigators did want a girl working with Arab girls, and so she's that girl. And Trudy Crawford is her buddy from, some of you know, from Sacramento, went out sort of on a similar thing, working as a nurse, and she has had a tremendous ministry in the Armenian hospital there. The hospital in Beirut, where these young Armenian student nurses come. I don't know whether all of them have come to Christ or not. Maybe, Berta, do you know? Most of the girls, most of the student nurses there are now Christians. And Trudy and then her buddy Sandy Verga, who went over to help, has helping these girls in Christian discipleship. Well, this is a tremendous ministry. And yet, they just went out as nurses because God led them. Donna Weber went to Wycliffe as secretary for a year or two, and now she's signed on as regular. By untying the hands of a branch director down in South America, she can really make it possible for a number of translators to be out in the tribes making putting the language into the New Testament. Mary Pat Lyson, some of you know her, in Minneapolis, is going down to teach in the same slot that Vangie Hedstrom had, teaching missionary children with the Wycliffe. Is it missionary children? Or, you know, yeah. And there's an opening there. There are short-term openings, there are long-term openings, there are jobs that haven't yet been thought of, that somebody has to think of, that can contribute to carrying out the Great Commission, even in a support role, which most of us probably would fill support roles because of being women, that we have skills that contribute more than skills that accomplish the evangelism. Well, however, Wycliffe has, most of its translators are single women. Most of their frontline translators, they send two girls into a tribe that would be hostile to men and would kill men if they'd walk in there. But these two helpless, harmless, innocent girls come in there and they feel obliged to take care of them instead of to kill them. And this happened in some of the tribes. And they say, what can these ignorant girls do? But if a man, able-bodied man had come in there, they probably would have slashed him in two. So the girls have done a lot in accomplishing translation of various languages in Wycliffe. I have here, just for an example, they gave us, we had a Wycliffe man here at the staff conference who handed out this sheet, they only have this one, showing jobs that Wycliffe could use right now, personnel, and I checked the ones a woman could fill. Bookkeeping and accountant, there's about 10 countries listed where they needed a bookkeeper and accountant. A hostess they need in 7 countries: Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, India, New Guinea, Vietnam, and West Africa. Now, Wycliffe and other missions too have long since abandoned their early 20s deadline for accepting personnel. They have long since abandoned their idea also of accepting personnel for only life or only long terms. They'll take, there are many missions that will take a person for a year, for 2 years, to see how both sides like it. There are many persons that will take an older person, younger person, because the risk they feel, sometimes they feel that maturity is more needed than physical strength, because a lot of times living these days on the mission field isn't living in the bush or the brush and killing your own buffalo. It's just living in another city, you know, and getting used to another culture. So a person who used to not be able to take it for health can now manage all right. So there's a lot fewer restrictions on overseas service than there used to be. One is literacy workers. They need them in 10 or 12 countries. They need Bible translators like mad. They need 60 in West Africa, 5 in Vietnam, 2 in Suriname, 10 in the Philippines, 10 in Peru, 16 in North America, 20 in New Guinea, North America, 40 in Mexico, 30 in India, Nepal, Ecuador, Colombia, Central America, Brazil, and Australia. That's quite a choice to pray about. And those are translators proper. The nurses, they need 4 nurses. This is what they could use right now, this year. Tribal nursing, 11 in Mexico. Computer operators, kindergarten teachers, typists, whole row of typists they need. It would be fun to type on the mission field. Secondary teachers, secretaries, artists, journalists, photography, elementary teachers, computer operators. Quite a choice. Things that can be done directly in the Great Commission in all these other countries. So they're just opportunities like everything. If the Lord can get us loose from the fish, pry us loose from the fish, and if He is allowed to choose, of course, to find out what He's going to choose takes some prayer, takes dedication, takes yieldedness, and takes time and devotion. It takes keeping our own life in touch with Him. This sheet lists about 25 evangelical mission organizations which could use personnel. Now, this list was made up here for the benefit of our own staff people. All of these missions, I think, are those that we rather know personally. We know their personnel, we know their executives, a lot of them. And we believe in these. We believe in the work they're doing. It isn't just a random list of missions. This is a list of missions who is heading in the direction that we feel God wants. So, and you're welcome. I don't know how many copies are here, but you're welcome to take a copy of these. If you like, I'll put them right here. And take a copy of these list of missions if you're interested in, like, inquiring. I think it's good to put out feelers like letters of inquiry and so on if you're thinking of maybe taking a year, going overseas, or taking 2 years, or even investing more of your life than that. And by the way, one of the gals that I had down here as an example of somebody who's gone somewhere and done something was Helen Harris. She left the Navigators before I came. She was staying with them a few months waiting to go out as a missionary to Africa. East Africa, which was pretty wild. She was 28. What's the first thing that comes to your mind? She's ruining her chances. She went out there, 28. And a missionary term is 4 or 5 years. Back in States for furlough. Well, you know, the chances look pretty slim for matrimony and that, something like that. She decided God wanted her to go to the mission field, and nothing stopped her. She went out there, and it so happened that God found her. He had marriage planned for her, Helen, and so He went all the way out there to find her. Wasn't that strange? But He can find us. He can find us if He has other plans. So let's not let this bother us about, you know, going out of reach of possible opportunities of other kind. Gurney Harris, the second, who's often spoken of as the second navigator. Dawson Trotman had Les Spencer, whose right arm you've heard about No, that's, let's see, right arm you've heard about. Have you heard about Les Spence's right arm?
No.
Well, he get somebody to tell you. In short, it was the idea that Les Spencer said, I'd give my right arm if I could do what you did, turning to your from scripture to scripture and leading somebody to the Lord. And Dawson Trotman said, the famous answer was, you can learn to do this, you can learn to handle the word, but it won't cost you your right arm, it'll cost you something. It'll cost you discipline, it'll cost you study, and it'll cost you giving yourself to it. Well, Lester and Gurney were the first two navigators who were sailors in those days. Gurney went to the mission field, interested in another girl, but not engaged or not finally committed, I guess. And Gurney married a girl, missionary, who was out on the field. Well, they came home on a furlough one time, their two tiny little children, and she died of a heart attack while she was home on furlough. Gurney went back out, and it wasn't too long in his next term before he married Helen Harris, who had gone out, or Helen Short, who had gone out as a 28-year-old single missionary, forever ruining her chances of happy marriage. So I just thought she was an interesting example of how God can find us. If he does have a change of plans, he can find us. So we must feel free to go ahead with whatever he leads us to do. Well, I think our time is gone. In fact, I know it is. John 20:21. Jesus again said to them, peace be with you. Just as my Father has sent me forth, so now I am sending you. He's sending us all into various parts of the world, whether it's Albuquerque or Stockholm or Johannesburg. So let's find out where he wants us and be there by all means and on time, because the time is running out. Jody, would you lead us in prayer?